I'm going to set Tim Jackson the impossible task of trying to offer a synthesis of everything we've heard and then offer some closing remarks. So, Tim.
Thank you, Ian. Thanks to Rob. And maybe I could just start really with acknowledging a debt of gratitude to all of those people that you've heard today, the researchers in Resolve. It's been a fantastic privilege to be, I'm not quite sure how to describe it. When I started thinking about the title for this presentation, the most obvious image actually wasn't the one that I had in my mind. And actually, particularly this ship, because as some of you might recognize, this is a very good mock-up of an early 20th century masterpiece of human engineering known as the Titanic. And in fact, as anyone who's tried it knows only too well, expecting academics from different disciplines to follow ship's orders from the captain's bridge is about as likely to be successful as herding feral cats in a feeding frenzy. And I say this, of course, with the greatest respect for my wonderful colleagues in Resolve and former friends. It has been... It's been a privilege. It's been an exciting journey. It's been a place, actually, of exploration, of difference and similarity, and of some incredibly exciting intellectual ideas. Actually, the image that I had in my mind in titling this, A View from the Bridge, was something more with the idea of the bridge as a crossing, a point of transition, if you like, Rob, from one place to the other, from one kind of society to the other, from the shores, if you like, of ecological crisis to the foothills of sustainability. Stand up, beautiful hills of sustainability, to paraphrase Walt Whitman's poem, actually, about the Brooklyn Crossing. And at the same time, I think I was thinking of the bridge as a different kind of crossing, the kind imagined metaphorically by one of my favorite playwrights, Arthur Miller, in a play called A View from the Bridge. And for Arthur Miller, the bridge is a place of personal and interpersonal tensions. It's a place of disparate loyalties and mixed motives. It's a place of moral and philosophical uncertainties. Because I think, actually, it's absolutely clear that this metaphor is at least one of the lessons that's emerged very clearly from Resolve over the last 5 years. Whether we're looking at the aficionados of sustainability, people with measurably pro-environmental values, deliberately living alternative lives, or whether we're looking at so-called ordinary people, people beset by changes and pressures they struggle to understand, lost in transition, thank you to Chris, from one set of circumstances to another, or whether we're looking at Jeremy Clarkson, as many of us love to do. And sometimes there's much less difference, as it turns out, between these stereotypes than we might wish there to be. What we find in all of these circumstances is more about tension and conflict than it is about clear-cut solutions to the ecological and social challenges of 21st century living. There are no silver bullets here. There are no magic carpets, no easy rides down the path of energy and carbon descent. And what we found instead, actually, has to do with complexity, with diversity, with limited tractability. And this complexity is typified, of course, by our multiplicity of functional needs and the carbon dependencies associated with them: food, clothing, shelter, health, education, communication, recreation and leisure, all intimately bound up with the carbon in our lives. And part of what we've done is to map these dependencies across different households, different circumstances, different locations. And we've seen how the impacts of consumption are increasingly embedded along complex supply chains that stretch for thousands of miles across continents and oceans, defying economic, cultural, and ecological boundaries. And we've also looked at how those patterns change over time and how they depend on complex interactions, governed, of course, by economic factors like price and income, but also by many non-economic factors. And this is one of my favorite bits of research from Resolve in a very particular sense, because it's not just first-class economic analysis. It's actually first-class economic analysis that tells you that first-class economic analysis is not enough. It says quite specifically that non-economic factors are an important part of the way that trends have changed over time in our economies. We've examined social and psychological complexities that attend these processes. We've monitored travel and eating and recycling and energy use in the home to find how meaning, identity, social status are inherently bound up in material practice. Compulsive shoppers have explained to us how social anxiety creates destructive spirals of spending and debt. We've charted the ways in which producers construct their consumers, priming them for expanding demand. We've seen people's natural desires for competence and performance open up commercial spaces ripe for invasion by corporate interest. We've charted a myriad social and psychological and economic processes which lead, despite our best intentions, not to reduction and restraint, but to an escalation, an acceleration of material demand and environmental impact. We've also modelled economic rebound, the process through which even our best achievements at energy restraint or carbon reduction are offset, because the money we save from good practice ends up generating carbon emissions somewhere else. We've mapped that continuing battle between efficiency on the one hand, our own clever technological advance, and scale on the other, the relentless expansion of material demands, watching in horror sometimes, and fascination certainly, as scale outweighs efficiency at every turn. We've paid a particular attention to sites of what we might call intentional change, to individuals, households, and communities with declared intentions to use less energy, to emit less carbon, to eat more sustainably, to invest more ethically, to live more frugally, to lead less materialistic lives. And when it comes to blueprints for sustainability, for living sustainably, surely there must be something to learn from these brave and sometimes foolhardy pioneers. At the very least, these social experiments — this is a picture of Ethical Man, with whom we had an early engagement with the BBC Newsnight programme — these social experiments should offer us insights about the journey we're on. How wide or how narrow is that crossing? How secure, how stable is the bridge? How precipitous is the drop on either side? How clear is the prospect ahead? What rewards and compensations offer themselves against the perils of the passage? And perhaps surprisingly, we've found that real and sometimes measurable differences characterize these groups and individuals. Some of them express stronger pro-environmental attitudes, hold stronger pro-social values. They may think of themselves in notably different ways. They may internalize aspects of their own changed practice into personal or social identities, as vegetarians, as cyclists, as conscientious parents, as ethical investors and consumers. They're liable to construct meaning in their lives differently and to resist the identities and meanings imposed on them by society. Sometimes, even more surprisingly, those who've chosen the path less traveled are in fact measurably happier than those around them. But the most striking finding, from my point of view, from these so-called intentional individuals and communities is not a rose-tinted vision of alternative prosperity, immediately transferable from the margin to the mainstream, but a set of enduring conflicts and tensions. And I think it's worth exploring a little how these tensions arise, where they come from. In the most concrete terms, they come directly from physical structures, from infrastructures of energy, of transport, of food provision, for example, that are totally inimical to sustainable practice. To take one example, to give up your car in a society built around roads is in fact to become a second or third class citizen. Margaret Thatcher's self-fulfilling prophecy that anyone over the age of 25 still traveling on a bus should consider himself a failure is a classic example of this tension. And anyone who thinks that 21st century Britain is a more forgiving place for pedestrians and cyclists than Thatcher's Britain probably hasn't travelled the length of the rather lovely Blackwater Valley path to be confronted by the three-line highway affectionately known as the Shepherd and Flock roundabout in Farnham, and then to find this rather wonderful sign, cyclists dismount. Dismount and then what, one is tempted to ask. Since there are no further signs, pavements, tracks of any kind, dismount and die, perhaps, is the message here. But it isn't just physical infrastructures which militate against sustainable living. It's institutional and social structures too. It's price signals and performance indicators. It's the ease of borrowing and the paucity of saving. It's the planning and execution of psychological and economic obsolescence. It's the pressure of the media and the structure of finance. It's the high cost of investment capital to households and the underwriting of private risk by ordinary taxpayers. It's the performance pressures on commercial fund managers. It's the efficiency metrics of public servants. It's the prevalence of commercial advertising and the erosion of public spaces. It's the relentless drive for increased productivity in professions that demand care, patience, and longevity. Perhaps most deep-rooted of all amongst these structures is our prevailing notion of social progress, characterized by the idea of ever-increasing incomes and expanding material aspirations, not just for the least well-off, who clearly deserve a better life, but even for the richest in society, whose only hopes of avoiding the pain of sacrifice lie with our ability to expand the size of the economy indefinitely. So it's a little surprise, I think, to find in the face of all that, that even those with the strongest motivations, with identities and worldviews bound up in ethical living, with self-declared intentions to live a more sustainable life, should find themselves in conflict, not just with the world around them, but with their own needs as social beings. Their best intentions to live sustainably are confounded not just by external forces, but by their own legitimate desires for social respect, for a decent life. The good life of the good person can only be realized in the good society, wrote the Islamic scholar Zia Sardar in an essay that I commissioned myself a few years ago for the Sustainable Development Commission. And if this is true for fully committed, intentional households and community, how much truer is it in mainstream households and communities? If the aficionados struggle, how can we expect ordinary people to fare any better? We've seen in some of our Resolve studies how change represents a threat to identity and to meaning. We've shown how it triggers resistance and loss of self-efficacy. This is about change in populations rather than change in individuals. It's about moving from the margin to the mainstream. It speaks directly to Julia Neuberger's point earlier about real lasting change at the level of the populations. And in intervention after intervention, in case study after case study in Resolve, we've underlined this one simple point: the best intentions of those who set out to change, to live better and more sustainably, are confronted again and again by the structures of unsustainability. Efficiency does battle with scale and makes only partial headway. Agency does battle with structure and often retreats in disarray. And our own scenario analysis shows that even under the best assumptions, actually, we are not going to meet those carbon targets set out by government policy. So if we're standing on a bridge, a crossing point, its foundations look profoundly shaky. To be honest, it's difficult to tell if the thing's been constructed properly at all beyond the midpoint of the river. And the task at hand seems profoundly daunting. The challenge for governance, certainly, is formidable. And we've looked at this question also in Resolve, and we've seen very clearly how concepts of governance are stretched by the demands of sustainable living, stretched in scale from the very local to the global, stretched in scope from the regulation of markets to the stimulation of technologies, to the setting of incentives, to the internalization of external costs, to the changing of behaviors and practices in businesses and households. And it's also become clear from that study that prevailing political ideologies offer fewer and fewer avenues for the kinds of real structural change demanded here. Two or three rather simplistic appeals have characterized recent response to the challenge of sustainable lives by government. One of these appeals is to the efficiency of the market, the power of commercial innovation to deliver technologies that will solve the problems we face. And this technological appeal is a truly tempting one for all sorts of reasons. Not the least of them is that new technologies are clearly needed. Renewable energy technologies, low carbon technologies, resource productivities, energy efficient appliances, all of these will be essential to achieve our carbon targets. But they won't in themselves be enough. And interestingly, it's not even possible to implement these technologies at the scale required without profound changes in behaviors and practices. Even relatively straightforward transformation of the building stock envisaged by the Green Deal requires changes, as yet ill-defined changes, in legislation and in government policy, in the behaviors of entrepreneurs, of retailers, of households, of investors, of financiers. And when it comes to the more complex changes required in the ways that we travel, the way we use energy in the home, the things we buy in the shops, the places we invest our money, our allegiance to our community, our engagement in change, our expectations in retirement, our aspirations for our children, our vision of social progress, policy is almost willfully blind to the demands of these tasks. A thin, rather ill-defined vision of individual behavior change, characterized by the popular terminology of nudge, is the best government currently has to offer here. By subtle shifts in the architecture of choice, people will miraculously become better citizens. They'll donate more organs. They'll recycle more waste. They'll buy more efficient vehicles. They'll wash their clothes at a lower temperature, and they'll turn off the tap while they're brushing their teeth. Again, these small-scale individual changes will not, and I think we should be clear about this, deliver the kinds of changes in populations that we need for sustainability. The one place where prevailing political ideology might have something useful to say about change at the community level seems bereft of substance. The rhetoric of localism and the big society is belied by the collapse of regional government, by funding strictures on local authorities, by the withdrawal of social investment, and a notable failure to address the vast inequalities of power and access and income that might promote the opportunity for people to flourish, and to flourish in less materialistic ways at the heart of vibrant communities. We should be, I think, on the evidence of resolve, under no illusions that these rhetorical devices are bankrupt, that platitudes about personal responsibility and choice architecture can't be substituted for real structural change, that there's no effective change strategy that involves one set of people in power preaching to people whose lives are already constrained by hardship, by social deprivation, by job insecurity, by declining real wages, while the prevailing inequalities of power and access and of income go unaddressed. Neither is there some magical solution that relies on promoting green consumption and breeding green consumers. In fact, the evidence suggests that the very idea of green consumers offers dubious credibility. There's broadly three sets of people, I would argue, who might be regarded as displaying some kind of interest in different greener consumption and purchasing choices. One set is already well-to-do, can afford premium prices, and already has high social standing. Another group has low or no social standing, doesn't expect to find it, and is green not from choice, but from necessity. And the third group, perhaps the most interesting, deliberately makes ethical decisions to live in more sustainable ways, and often more frugal ways, eschewing conventional norms and creating meaning in new and unconventional ways. But as we've seen, this group continually come up against wider social structures that militate against the changes they would like to make, against the values they would like to hold. This is a very clear message, I think, from Resolve work. But is it all that we can say? Is this where the collective wisdom of Resolve leads us? Is our task in reporting to policy academics talking to policy, one simply of instilling realism into narratives about sustainability? Is it just a question of articulating as clearly as possible that consumer capitalism itself will never be sustainable, that the direction of travel is far too slow, that prevailing market-driven ideologies are in many places counterproductive, that realistic scenarios of change show too little progress towards desired targets? I believe it is our job to say some of these things. I think the evidence we've gathered, the analyses we've carried out over the last 5 years support these views. But I don't believe that this task of injecting realism into jaded policy exhausts the importance of our work in Resolve. On the contrary, I'm convinced there are more important things to say. I think our evidence base contains seeds of hope. It has within it visions of change. And these visions, as somebody suggested earlier this afternoon, actually will provide invaluable inputs, not just in terms of evidence, but in terms of creativity in the crossing to sustainability. And just as a few examples of those kinds of seeds of hope, we've shown in some of our research how, in fact, the carbon implications of a decent life, a life in which one can flourish and participate, are already around 40% lower than the average carbon household today. We've identified the existence of strong environmental and social values in the unlikeliest of places, aspirations of fairness that extend beyond fairness to me and my family, and also convey allegiance to the fairness in society as a whole, fairness towards other people. We've uncovered countless examples of social innovation, the circulation and reinvention of new ideas, grassroots revolutions in growing and providing food, in the transformation of local energy systems, in the provision of community finance, in the organization of social and community-based enterprise. We've explored what I think is a rich vein of renewed political and social activism in a younger cohort of the population. We found a generation that risks and fears unprecedented financial insecurity, but it is also a cohort that has and holds deep concerns about the environment, that is full of creativity and is highly motivated by visions of self-sufficiency and of sustainability. A new generation that understands and sometimes even resists material excess. A generation, above all, that possesses and fiercely protects its own sense of social agency, the ability to effect social change and make the world a better place. "The human animal is a beast," wrote Tennessee Williams in Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. The speech is from Big Daddy. "A beast that dies. And if he's got money, he buys and buys. And I think the reason he buys everything he can is that in the back of his mind, he has the crazy hope that one of his purchases will be life everlasting." We've seen in some of our work that there are narratives of meaning and identity that offer a real alternative to the consumer culture. They, in fact, offer consolation, senses of purpose that consumer culture simply cannot offer, suggesting that less materialistic lives might also be more meaningful. None of us, I think, is under any illusion that these findings are sufficient on their own to make living sustainably a reality. If you want a view from a bridge, find yourself a small bridge to nowhere and keep your eyes firmly shut, and it will probably do the job for a short period of time. The clearest message of all from our research is the need for profound structural change to support the initiatives of communities and individuals already engaged in transition. But these seeds of hope, these visions of change, these practical manifestations of more sustainable lives, I think make the view from the bridge a brighter, a more colourful, a more promising place than we might otherwise come to expect. This may look like a small-scale folk concert. It is. It is a small-scale folk concert in a tent, a community actually doing it for itself in a small town very close to where I live. But what's interesting to me about this example is that this is, in fact, a community investing in its own ecological assets. It's a tiny example, but it is a way of community protecting its own assets into the future. This was a concert organized on a small patch of land which the town itself had decided it wanted to save from development and had organized a fund. And in fact, the Bishop's Meadow Trust is in the process of building a consortium, building a sense of interest, building social capital, as been referred to before, and creating what is here, just in this tiny picture, a unique example of community employing culture to protect its ecological assets into the future. Seeds of hope need only be quite small. Visions for the future don't have to be immediate and blinding. They start in ways that are difficult to predict. They build in ways that even over the space of 5 years, no one could have predicted what would happen in the Transition Town movement. And sometimes, in some of these initiatives, in some of these seeds of hope, things actually go well. Sometimes, perhaps I'll finish as I started with a poem. This one is from Sheena Pugh. Sometimes things don't go, after all, from bad to worse. Some years, muscadel faces down frost. Green thrives. The crops don't fail. Sometimes a man aims high and all goes well. Sometimes our efforts, our best efforts, do not go amiss. Sometimes we do as we meant to. The sun will sometimes melt a field of sorrow that seemed hard frozen. May it happen for you, Sheena Pugh, in the poem Sometimes. That really is my summary. It's a trot through an enormous adventure, a fantastic wealth of material. And I'll finish really just by thanking again the team in Resolve, the researchers in Resolve who made that journey possible. Thank you very much.